don't be afraid of brain drain, because for one thing, you cannot prevent everyone, right, from leaving country. Even if you're able to do, then you can only isolate yourself from the rest of the world. So take a chance, but think about how you can convert brain drain into something else, either circulation or linkage.
Hi, friends and fellows. Welcome to this special series of conversations involving personalities coming from a number of campuses, including Stanford University. The purpose of this series is really to unleash thought-provoking ideas that I think would be of tremendous value to you. I want to thank you for your support so far, and welcome to this special series.
Hi, today we're with Professor Gi-wook Shin, who is the director of APARC at Stanford University, but he's also a professor of sociology and also the founding director of the Korea program at Stanford University. Gi-wook, thank you so much for coming on to our show.
Yeah, thank you. It's my pleasure and my honor to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, how you grew up and how you moved to the United States and all the way to Palo Alto.
Okay, first of all, as you mentioned, I was born and grew up in Korea. And I finished my college in 1983. Okay. And during my college year, we are involved in like a political movement, because I entered college in 1979. In the fall of the year, Korean President Park Chung-hee was killed by his intelligence chief. And in 1980 and 81, we are involved in political movement, fighting for democracy.
Right.
And as I was graduating, I was really debating, what to do. I mean, should I get a job and study more? If so, then in Korea or go outside? But as I was growing up, I was influenced by United States quite a bit, because my father was church minister, and then he knew many American missionary. So at the time, we were involved in anti-American movement in college. So I thought I was going to Germany. But then my father saying, no, you should go to United States if you want to study. So that's why I came to U.S. in 1983 to University of Washington. And at the time, I was quite sure that I would go back to Korea with my PhD. But I'm still here after 40 years. Yes.
And what did you study and what did you pursue as soon as you finished your studies in Washington?
Yep. Right, so I went to a sociology program.
Right.
And, initially I didn't think about studying Korea, because, while you're studying Korea in the States, right? So you might study more theoretical issue or American society, politics. But then after a few years, I realized that there are very little study in Korea.
Right.
So I don't know, maybe I was a little nationalistic at the time. So that, I got to study in Korea. That's why I came to write my dissertation on Korean social movement during colonial rule by Japanese. So in a sense, maybe my experience in Korea during college influenced me to have interest in social movement, but also on Korea. That's why I study Korea social movement, nationalism, development. And then as I was finishing up my PhD, as I mentioned, I was going back to Korea. But then, my friends, my American friends, they are on the job market. And I said, you know, why not testing myself? Okay, I was fairly young at the time. I think I was 30 or 31. Mm. So, okay, I said, okay, let's try. I didn't expect, but I got a job offer from University of Iowa. Mm. And until then, I never been to Iowa. So when I mentioned Iowa to my Korean friends, they're saying, they got confused. Iowa, Idaho, or Ohio, right? But, you know, it was a good job. It's in the Midwest, yeah. You know, very nice public college. And, you know, I had one child just born right before my graduation. So we spent, you know, 3 years at Iowa. So, you know, as you know, you know, life doesn't evolve right. As you plan or intend, right? Because, you know, when I went to Iowa, I thought I might stay for a few years, getting experience, and go back to Korea. But I think after 2 years or so, and I got an offer from UCLA, which is a nice university.
Yeah, warmer.
In LA, much warmer. So I moved to UCLA, okay? And then, well, still I was debating whether I should stay or I should go back. And then I got one child at Seattle, the second at Iowa, the third one in LA. So every time I move, I got a child. And then I got tenure at UCLA in 1998. So, you know, for some of you who don't know American academics, you know, tenure is very crucial because if you get tenure, then you have job security. In American university, there's no age of retirement.
Right.
So once you have a tenure, then you can work
do anything
until, you know, you want to retire. So especially now, people are living longer. So it's a nice deal. But anyway, so going back to my UCLA, still I was debating. And I got tenure and I got three children. Then my wife kept, you know, telling me, you know, make up your mind. You know, go back to Korea or stay here. So I'll, you know, support your decision, but you got to decide. You just can't debate, you know, every night, every day, right? Okay, then I think late 99 or 2000, I got a contact from Stanford saying they want to establish a Korea program, then asking if I have any interest. You can... Right,
you can't tough to refuse.
Yeah, you can refuse. Right. So, I got an offer from 2001, and then I came here. So, at the time I was about to take over in a very large Korea center at UCLA. But here, I mean, a lot of promise, a lot of potential, but still I have to start from the beginning. So I was joking that I'm leaving large company for startup. So I came here 2001, establishing a Korea program. So now it's more than 20 years.
Yeah.
And I don't have any regrets.
Yeah.
And I think it was the right decision.
Yeah.
And I feel very lucky and very fortunate that I'm able to teach and work here at Stanford.
Well, the weather is perfect also.
Yeah, weather is nice.
I want to deep dive a little bit on you've written more than 20 books and talk a little bit about how South Korea has become what it is. I mean, it is one of the very few countries that's really great at projecting soft power.
Right.
And just talk about how that came about.
Right. So, you know, 40 years ago, okay, let me share you know, a few episodes.
Right.
Because in 1980s, as some of you may know, it's all about Japan. Okay. You know, Japan was really developing fast.
Right.
And, you know, some people believe that Japan might take over United States in a few years.
Yeah.
But Korea, I mean, there are two things still you know, stick to my mind. Okay, one is in American TV, they were still showing this kind of, you know, drama episode, you know, MASH.
Yeah.
get messages about Korea during Korean War.
Right.
So very poor, a lot of orphans, and it's a really bad situation. Yeah, that was Korea in 1950s and 60s. The other one, Samsung, just began to export HTV. And if you go to Costco, that really the corner get very small black Samsung TV.
Right.
It's really at the bottom. And at the time, many Korean students, my friends, their dream when they go back to Korea was to buy a 25-inch color TV from Sony. Okay, so Samsung couldn't, there's no way Samsung could match, Sony at the time.
Right.
Okay, so a small black Samsung TV, very nice, large color Sony TV.
Yeah.
So that was 1980s. But now things change a lot. Now, not only economically, but also culturally, Korean drama, K-pop, they became very popular. I mean, not only here, but in the Indonesia, Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
It's a big change. Now, Samsung, LG are making the best electronic, goods, right? Yeah. And then, people using Samsung, phone along with the iPhone. So I think over 40 years, tremendous growth. I mean, in that sense, it may not be exaggeration to say it was a miracle for Korea. I mean, even for myself, because I experienced over the last 40 years, I was able to see with my eyes how Korea was able to really take off.
Yeah. What made it possible?
I think, there are many reasons, but I think maybe I can say, a couple of things. One is political leadership.
Yeah.
I think that's very important, especially, as President Park Chung-hee, even though he was dictator, he really was able to, take Korea to next level economically. But not only that, a lot of Korean people were fighting for democracy. Okay, so that's why Korea was able to develop economically and politically. So if you look at the countries in the world after 1945, there are only a few countries that were able to achieve both economic development and political democracy.
Yeah.
I think that's one big factor. And the other one, I just say, human capital.
Right.
As Korea has invested a lot in human capital.
Yeah.
And sometimes a bit too excessive. I think still they are spending a lot of money in educating, their children. And in the process, they sent a lot of people abroad, like myself. Okay. And then many of them, not me, but many of them came back to Korea with education, with experience, and then they really made a contribution to Korea. So, unlike Indonesia, Korea is a fairly small country.
Very small.
Very poor in natural resources.
Mm.
So, but they really invested in human capital.
Yeah.
And I think that's why they are able to develop quite fast and pretty well. Now even Korean universities are really doing quite well.
Yeah.
So I think they are leaders among Asian universities. So I think leadership, I think investment in human capital and maybe engaging the outside world, openness. I think those are very crucial for Korean success.
In the famous words of the former leadership of Singapore, who talked about Lee Kuan Yew, who talked about how Singapore was steadfast with respect to selecting the top talents to teach.
Mm.
And he would, occasionally make the comment that South Korea takes it to the next level when you would select teachers.
Mm.
You would select it actually from the top 5%. Singapore would try to do it from the top 20%.
Mm.
You've seen a metamorphosis in a big way, right? In the last few decades, right? aside from the political leadership, what else do you think made it possible? Because it would have taken a very much collective effort, right, for everybody to basically subscribe to the idea that excellence is not to be underestimated. Excellence is not to be moderated or whatever. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not sure, you know, these days, but at least during, you know, Korea's takeoff, I do say maybe sense of urgency, maybe you know, even nationalism, you know, very important. Because, you know, Korea, you know, is surrounded by big powers, you know, China, Japan, Russia, and also, you know, divided, you know, North Korean threat. So I think there's a big urgency that unless you can develop quickly and successfully, you know, you might become, you know, colony again or taken over by communism. So I think that was quite important. I think a lot of people were willing to sacrifice their own interests for national interests. So, you know, certainly like Park Chung-hee was very authoritarian. And then a lot of people sacrificed their human rights and political rights. But still, you know, many people were willing to work and even sacrifice themselves for national interest. So I think that was, you know, very important, at least in 1960s through maybe 80s, if not now. Yeah.
Do you believe that South Korea will be able to maintain this competitive spirit? Unlike what we might have seen with Japan,
right?
They kind of like, I think, started slowing down, relatively speaking here, relative to what the Koreans have done. Do you see that as a possibility happening with the Koreans?
I think that's a big question for Korea because, you know, for the good or bad, Korea has been following Japan in many ways. So developmental model basically you know, came from Japan. And now, you know, Korea is having a demographic crisis.
Right.
I mean, like aging population, you know, very low birth rates. I think right now, Korea's birth rate is like even less than 0.8.
Wow.
The lowest in the world.
Yeah.
So that they are really, you know, moving very fast. And then working age, you know, populations are declining.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of concern that whether Korea will follow the steps that you know Japan has taken for last 20 years. So I think in order to avoid, in my view, there are a few things. You know, one is Korea needs to stay connected to the outside world. I think for Japan, you know, as they will become more successful, I think they are somewhat becoming inward looking, more detached from global trends like 90s and 2000. So you know, even today, you know, you don't see many Japanese, you know, students in American universities. And I think a lot of young Japanese just feel very comfortable living in their own their own place. And I know that Japanese government is really trying to promote young Japanese to go abroad, have some experience, education. But then oftentimes, they just go for 1 week, 2 weeks.
That's true.
Study tour.
That's true.
Okay, so, but still, I think, you know, many Koreans still coming to U.S. and other countries.
Yeah.
So I think they should continue. And the other one, I think, you know, Korea should really embrace, you know, migration of skilled labor. As you know, like Japan, Korea, they are very homogeneous, you know, ethnically. And, you know, with all due respect, Korea or Japan is not a good place for foreigners.
Yeah.
I mean, there's racism, there's, you know, ethnic discrimination.
Yeah.
And, I mean, last, you know, 20, 30 years, Korea, Japan were taking unskilled labor from China and Southeast Asia. Because Koreans don't want to work anymore in what they call 3D industry, right? Difficult, mm-hmm. dangerous, and what's the other one?
Difficult,
dangerous,
and dangerous, dirty.
And dirty, right? So, I mean, that has been going on. But now Korea needs to import, you know, foreign talent, you know, skilled labor, because, you know, population is aging. You know, Korean government has been spending a lot of money to boost the birth rate, but they keep declining. I mean, think about like 0.7 something. That's incredible,
that's
right?
That's really low.
So how you want to, you know, survive? So I think, you know, Japan came to realize this importance, and they are trying to attract more foreign talents, but a little too late. And then unless they open up, you know, socially, culturally, it's very hard, because now, you know, Korea is about like top 10 country in the world. If you account for, you know, economic, you know, military, cultural power, maybe let's say 10 to 15, to be fair.
Yeah.
And then you got to compete with other advanced country in attracting, you know, foreign talent. So whenever I go to Korea, Japan, or when they come to our place, I mean, you know, we are in Silicon Valley, and they say they like to emulate Silicon Valley in Korea, in Japan. I said, you know, unless you can embrace, you know, foreign talent, and unless you can promote cultural diversity, just forget it.
Not gonna happen.
Right, because, you know, Silicon Valley was not built just by, you know, white Caucasian American.
Yeah.
You know, Indians, Chinese, other immigrants, they all came, they were welcomed, they are working together to make innovation and build Silicon Valley. But then can global talent come to work and live in Korea or Japan? You know, you have to think about, right?
Yeah.
So certainly, you know, Seoul has become a global city, you know, Tokyo has become a global city. And it's fun to visit there for short term, for tourism. But can they really come and work and live with other Korean, Japanese people? It's just still very hard.
Yeah.
And so unless you can embrace cultural diversity, embrace, you know, foreign global talent, it's very hard to survive. So can they make it? I think that's a big challenge, and it won't be easy. Yeah. But I think they should take it very seriously.
Is this something that the political leadership is sensitive to?
Right.
Okay. So they might be taking a view on this, right?
At some point. I think they recognize, but I think there are a couple of issues. One is politically,
right?
It may not pay off because, you know, there's some public concern that if we import foreign talent, they may take some jobs away from our young people.
Yeah.
I don't think that's like an assumption, but still that's a view. The other one, you know, Koreans, also Japanese, in the same way, they are so used to just living with fellow Koreans, fellow Japanese.
Yeah.
They just don't feel comfortable living with, you know, foreigners.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's why, you know, education is very important.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I give a lecture to like a Korean, like a college student. And I'm asking, you know, what does it mean to be global?
Yeah.
I mean, does it mean having good English? I think a lot of people may live that way because, you know, Koreans spend a lot of time and money in learning English. And now young people, their English is better than mine. No, seriously. But then, you know, they don't really teach or spend money or time in learning cross-cultural skills.
Yeah.
So in my view, and this is what I'm telling to Korean people, to be global means understanding a different culture, having cross-cultural skills. Okay, these are more important than having, you know, good English.
Yeah.
And I'm even joking that sooner or later, you know, Google can translate, you know, you know, your language into, you know, English, right? So I mean, that's why, you know, they should teach, you know, more to young Korean people about the value of diversity and cross-cultural skills, you know, more than just English.
You've been spending a lot of time talking about brain drain.
Right.
Give us a new definition of brain drain, if there is any.
Right. So, you know, as I mentioned, you know, I've been working on this topic for many years.
Right.
And I wrote one book on global talent using Korea as a case.
Right.
And right now I'm writing a book to compare Japan, Australia, China, India. I'm calling them as like a talent giant because I think their talent strategies were very crucial to their economic prominence. And maybe you can compare now, you know, China and India for a moment, okay? Because, you know, China and India, okay, both of them suffered, you know, huge brain drain initially.
Right.
Because, as you know, a lot of talented Chinese Indian went abroad.
Right.
Okay. So from conventional perspective, they're brain drain. Okay. But it doesn't have to be a permanent loss, you know, for their countries.
Right.
You can convert the brain drain into developmental asset, okay, through different you know, policies. So in our project, initially I thought, you know, China, India were very similar, but actually they pursue different strategies. So for China, they sent a lot of Chinese, then trying to bring back.
Right.
Okay, which I call, you know, brain circulation. And then this is what happened in Korea, in Taiwan. I think probably in Malaysia now, they're trying to do more brain circulation.
So,
you know, you have to lose first to, you know, to gain back later. But, you know, India pursued quite different strategy because a lot of Indians left after college. They never come back.
Not intending to come back, yeah.
So if you come to Silicon Valley, get a lot of Indians in really, you know, executive level in big companies like, you know, Google, you know, Sundar Pichai is one example.
Right.
But there are so many high-level executives in Silicon Valley companies. So they never go back to live in India, but still they engage.
Yeah.
You know, their home country, okay, in many ways.
They still send money back to India too.
Yeah, not only money, but like, you know.
Know-how.
Know-how, and then they are, you know, taking some Indian talent to university, to companies. So right now, as you may know, in the States, there's a visa called H-1B visa for skilled labor.
Right.
Do you know what percentage of H-1B visa holders are Indian?
30-40%?
No, more than
that's
that.
Under,
it's almost like 75%.
My gosh.
Okay.
Well, I'm not that shocked.
Yeah, the Chinese only like 10% or 12%.
Wow. Indonesians probably less than 1%.
Yeah. So I think one reason, of course, there are a lot of high-skilled, qualified people, but also their networks. Okay. I think, you know, Indians in India, they know how to apply for H-1B.
How many percent are Koreans?
Very small.
5, 10?
No, even maybe less than that. Yeah. So think about, you know, India, like 70, China, you know, 10, that's 80-85%, right?
Wow.
The rest are like 15%, right? So, sure, I mean, you know, China, India, they had a brain drain initially.
Yeah.
But eventually, they were able to gain back much more, you know, dividends much later. So in a sense, this is my own story because, as I mentioned earlier, I left Korea.
Yeah.
And I mean, Korea invested in me for 20 years, right? Up to college, right?
And you're still going back to Korea to teach.
Right. So I never, you know, went back to Korea. So from conventional perspective, it's a brain drain. But from new perspective, then I'm arguing it's not. It's more like brain linkage because I engage in Korean universities and I engage in Korean policymakers, you know, even business. And I'm trying to bridge between Korea and United States.
Yeah.
So I think it can be win-win for both home country and host countries. With globalization, I think this is becoming more and more important.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm saying that even like a developing country in Asia, don't be afraid of brain drain. Because for one thing, you cannot prevent everyone, right, from leaving country. Even if you're able to do, then you can only isolate yourself from the rest of the world. So take a chance, but think about how you can convert brain drain into something else, either circulation or linkage.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a main argument on my project right now.
It's a very powerful message, and it really depends on a time frame, right?
Right.
If you put this in a long time frame, it all makes sense in that it accrues to everybody. Mm. It's a positive sum game.
Mm.
But what's your sense on how this could be politicized in some countries as a net negative, the notion of brain drain?
Right. So I think if you talk to, I'm sort of working, with ADB on project. And I think for, international development community, there's a big debate whether we should invest in higher education for a developing country. Because, one critique is that, if we educate, people, then they will leave.
Right.
So that you may be wasting your money and resource, right? So that's why many people say that it's better to invest in K-12 for less developed country.
Yeah.
But my argument, then they can never be developing their own country. Yeah. They still remain forever as less developed, right?
Yeah.
So still invest in higher education, can let them go out, and once again then figure out how you can convert possible brain drain into circulation or linkage.
Yeah.
Once again, that's why Korea, Taiwan, they were able to succeed.
Yep.
So that's explained China's success as well.
And India. Yeah.
And in this case, India has a lot of promise.
Yeah.
So, and then if I add a little more, I see more now regional talent mobility within Asia Pacific region, because now even like Korea, Japan, they need foreign talent because of demographic crisis, right? And universities in Korea, Japan, Australia, they are getting better and better, right? And then for many people in, let's say, in Southeast Asia, it will be easier to go to study in Korea, Japan than in the United States, right? I mean, maybe it's a little easier to get in than
closer,
cheaper, right?
Yeah.
So certainly, this brain circulation linkage for Indian Chinese happened largely with North America, like the United States. I think for Indonesian, Malaysian, Bangladeshian,
right,
I think they should take advantage of this regional talent flow. So send them more to Korea, more to Japan, more to Australia, and then Singapore, and then figure out, how you're going to utilize get those talents after education, after work experience. I think this is a very important policy question for political leaders in those countries.
Yeah. I mean, I've kind of shared this with you separately before. If we take a look at the number of Indonesians studying in the U.S. in the 80s, it was around 16,000.
Mm.
Now it's dwindled to 8,000. To 8,500. And I remember in the 80s, we used to think that we had as many Indonesians as South Koreans in the U.S. Now it's like we're looking at, more than 100,000 Koreans in the U.S. studying at any given time at all universities, right? Whereas the Indonesians, they amount to around 8,000 to 8,500. That is, I think, something that needs to be taken a view of.
Yeah.
If we really want to, become better going forward, learning from other places, wisdom that I think could be beneficial.
So do they stay in Indonesia or go to university in Asia?
There's been some rotational behavior.
Mm.
They have been going more to Australia, to Japan, Malaysia, Singapore, places that are much nearby and cheaper.
Okay.
But we have bigger wallet now.
Right.
We can afford right. yeah. to send people
yeah.
to places like Europe, the United right. States. So, yeah. You know, you've been working on this new program called the Policy Lab,
right.
the Next Asia Policy Lab at Stanford. Talk about that.
Yeah. Okay. That's a new project.
Yeah.
So we are going to open this Policy Lab. July of this year, so mm-hmm. we got only like a few months away. So here there are, you know, I think maybe two key words. Okay, one is next Asia,
mm.
okay, and the other one Policy Lab. So the next Asia means how we can upgrade, you know, Asia to next level. I mean, yeah. we are talking about like a new Asia, but the new Asia has been used, you know, too much, overused, right? So I think here main thinking is that sure, you know, Asia has come along, you know, quite well for last several decades. But how can they move up to the next level? Okay, it's not only economically, but you know, socially, culturally, in education, as I mentioned, you, right. know, you know, earlier. So that's our main idea. So and then the second one, you know, Policy Lab, which means that sure, we are going to do very rigorous, you know, research, but it's not going to be purely academic or theoretical. So we like to draw some, you know, policy implications based on our research. And there are four research tracks. The one is talent and development, which I mentioned earlier. Right. The second one, nationalism and racism. So we talk about, you know, racism in the States a lot, but then there's a lot of racism in Asia as well.
Yeah.
Third one, U.S.-Asia relations, especially we like to compare U.S.-China relations of today with U.S.-Japan relations of the 1980s. The last one, democratic crisis and right. reform. So I think for each track, we are in the process of hiring like a postdoctoral fellow. And then we have some research associates, and we're going to involve our students.
Yeah.
But also, we are going to invite some visiting scholar from Asia. So anyone listening to this, this show.
Listen.
And then if you like to spend your sabbatical, then, you know, that's a good opportunity. So, and then I think eventually we like to involve some, you know, Asian students from Asia, especially.
Right.
Smart, promising, ambitious young people,
yeah.
but from underprivileged, you know, background or families. So this will be really, you know, projects of collaboration. So I like to really create a great team,
yeah.
and then not only doing academic research but engaging, you know, our policy community, academic community here and also in Asia. So. As I mentioned, you know, I'm from Asia, and I feel it's my mission to bridge between Asia and United States in academia, in policy community, and education, and so on. So it's a really exciting project.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can share more exciting news later. But we are all preparing for the launch of this new lab in the summer.
It sounds really good. I don't want to take this a little bit further in the context of this decoupling between China and the U.S. and how that has and is likely to affect the posturing of South Korea going forward. I mean, it's safe to assume that, you know, for the layman like me, Korea would look to the U.S. for security, but look to China.
Right.
For economic purposes.
Right.
And how do you see this developing going forward?
Right. So this is also, you know, central challenge, you know, for Korea and I think in many other countries in Asia. So in the past, main paradigm was like, U.S. for security and economy, I mean, China for economy, because Korea has a military alliance with the United States. But, you know, China has been a major trading partner.
Right.
Okay, so for the last 10, 20 years.
Yeah.
But now, as you know, yeah, there's some trend for decoupling. And then you know, some area of economy like semiconductor. So that is being closely linked to security. So in some area, it's very hard to separate economy from security. Like semiconductor is one good example. So now I think some Korean companies like Samsung, SK, okay, they're moving, I think they're trying to move from China to United States,
yep,
or maybe go to India, Vietnam, or Indonesia.
Yeah.
But it's not easy,
yeah,
because they already made a huge investment in China.
Yeah.
And it's much more expensive,
yeah,
to come to United States. India, Indonesia, still infrastructure is not as good as in China.
Yeah.
And then you can't really agitate China either. So I think this is a really difficult issue for China. So certainly, U.S. is pushing, you know, Korea and some other countries to work with the United States. But it's a big yeah, big challenge, a very tough issue,
yeah,
for Korea for sure.
The slowness with respect to shifting supply chain capabilities, right, from China onto places like Southeast Asia is not because of lack of desire,
right,
to reshore, friendshore, or offshore.
Right.
But I, as you aptly pointed out, it's the lack of capacity to increase marginal productivity.
Right.
You know, within many places in Southeast Asia, rule of law,
right,
and also the infrastructure that's needed.
Governance.
Yeah. So I think the rhetoric is a lot louder.
Right.
On reshoring,
right,
compared to the reality on the ground.
Yeah.
And this is something that I think policymakers in Southeast Asia need to be more cognizant of.
Right.
And hopefully they can do something about it.
Right.
But how do you see Korea moving forward in this context? I mean, you've got the Taiwan issue. You've got the U.S.-China issue.
Mm-hmm.
What's your, you know, take on this?
Right. I think, you know, one issue is, certainly Korea is a democratic society.
Right.
And there's change in regime, right? But then there's so much change, you know, with changing government.
Yeah.
And I think Korea needs some more consistency in policy. But for example, now the conservatives are back to power. So they're really moving away from, you know, policies that previous government pursued. Okay, so now certainly they are trying to strengthen alliance with the United States.
Right.
And President Yoon Suk-yeol just went to Tokyo because the bilateral relations between Japan and South Korea was really soured for last several years.
Yep.
But still, North Korean threat is very serious. And how to deal with China, right? I mean, that's a big issue. And now their growing concern is, what if there's a military tension over Taiwan?
Right.
Then what Korea can do? So I think now, you know, Korea is facing multiple challenges in national security.
Yep.
And it's really daunting in the challenge.
I want to switch to democracy,
yeah,
right? I think you've alluded to the fact that democracy has been in recession in many places.
Right.
How do we fix that?
Right. So that's also a big question. And, you know, I've been speaking out about democratic crisis in Korea. And as you mentioned, you know, Korea is not unique. I mean, we have seen a similar democratic erosion, I mean, even in this country, in UK,
right,
and many parts of the world.
Yeah.
Now, like, for example, like, you know, political polarization,
yeah,
is really extreme. Okay, certainly there has been some disagreements about, you know, policy towards North Korea, US, and so on. But now this polarization is really serious.
Yeah.
When I you know, go to Korea, I see that, like, you know, people from you know, different political ideological camp, they don't talk,
yeah,
to each other. And this social media is only aggravating.
Makes it worse, yeah.
The situation. And so how to, you know, get together, you know, Korean people for national agenda. As I mentioned, Korea is facing, you know, big challenge. But the Korean people are divided. So I often remind the Koreans of what happened in late 19th century. Because at the time, Korea was divided. Like a pro-Russian, pro-Chinese, pro-Japanese, pro-American. And then eventually, you know, Korea became Japanese colony. So of course, it's not only because of Koreans' faults. But still, if they were able to have some, you know, consensus, then probably they could have, you know, dealt with better with Japanese aggression. So now, you know, Korea is facing a lot of problems, but then Koreans are so divided and fighting against each other. It's just really bad to see those infighting among themselves. And so, you know, I've been saying that, sure, I mean, Korea is, you know, a democratic country. You know, they are largely following rule of law.
Right.
But they should really promote democratic, you know, thinking and spirit, you know, value. So that rule of law is necessary but not sufficient for mature democracy. And now you have to respect, you know, other people. And especially during the last, you know, government, they really divide, you know, people, you know, good versus evil. Okay, so the other side is not only political opponents, but they are like enemy, you know, evil. So they should be punished. So when you try to label the other side from, you know, moral perspective, good versus evil, it's very hard to compromise. Right? So they should be punished. You know, we are the one who just, you know, carry in our nation. So I think a lot of bad blood being shed, and it's not a really good situation. And, you know, even now with the new government, you know, Mr. Yoon's rating, like between, I say, 30 to 40%, right? So it's very hard to mobilize people for national agenda when you have, you know, low you know, ratings. So I think he needs to be more inclusive, embracing different sectors of society to carry on his main agenda.
Social media has been a big reason, right, for the inability of both sides to talk to each other. What's your take on what needs to be done from a policy or a political standpoint with respect to social media?
Right. So, you know, I don't do any social media.
Your wife does.
Yeah, my wife does. So I only do, you know, email because I have to survive for my work. But
but it's a reality for a lot of people out there.
Right. And then, you know, Koreans, you know, almost all Koreans do, you know, Kakao Talk, like Kato, and I don't do that. Some of my Korean friends complain, and I don't do any Kato. So I mean, it's a, you know, democratic society. I mean, so they should be allowed, you know, freedom of speech, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a good idea to regulate, you know, through law, right? So, but I think, but I mean, that's why this like promoting, you know, culture of tolerance, you know, diversity. You know, these are very important because, you know, otherwise, I mean, social media is only means, right? And then it can be used for, you know, many different reasons, right? Different, you know, goals, right? It can be used for good or for bad, right? And now, I mean, there are some, you know, good function of social media. But then how you're going to regulate, I don't think it's a good idea for governments to crack down certain media. Yeah. But at the same time, I don't know, it might take a long time, but we really have to educate the values of diversity, you know, tolerance and understanding. Otherwise, I mean, these days, like, you know, YouTube, and for example, like, you know, Koreans do a lot of YouTube, and some of the contents are really a lot of problems.
Well, we're doing what we're doing.
Yeah. So, you know, but this is great. But some of them, I mean, a lot of fake news or false information.
Yeah.
And I'm telling my wife, don't watch Korean YouTube. There's a lot of misinformation. Yeah. So how are you going to do? I mean, you can go back to authoritarian years, right? They're cracking down. So I think we have to educate how to improve. So I don't know. After all, I still believe in the value of education. It might take some time.
I agree.
But we have to work together to educate.
I'm a little
your
concerned.
Your podcast can help.
Amen.
For that,
I'm just a little concerned with, how people equate algorithmic amplifications with democracy.
Right.
And how people keep thinking that we need to dignify freedom of speech when that speech is actually paid for.
Right.
By way of the virality so that you get the necessary number of clickbaits so you can advertise and whatever. It doesn't seem to get fixed by policymakers, politicians, much less the technology owners.
Yeah.
It does require some view taking, I think, for democracy to come out of this recession, in many places.
But I think also that involves a political leadership.
Yeah.
I think in this society, people don't trust or they don't have any respect for political leaders.
Yeah.
So that even when the leaders are saying something, then people don't either trust or believe. And then they just go on their own way, sharing their own views, sometimes misinformation. So I think political leaders should regain trust and respect from people. I think that's one way of solving or at least mitigating this problem.
Yeah. I'm curious about your view on where China and India are going to end up globally. They've done really well in this context of brain circulation in different ways,
right?
But how do you foresee them in the next couple of decades or a few decades?
Okay, so with China, I got to be a little careful.
I don't mean to put you on a spot, but I think, it's important for the audience to hear your wisdom.
Right. So I think, China has done so well for last several decades.
Right.
Okay. And so in my view, there are a few things. So one is, openness. As I mentioned, they sent a lot of talented people.
Right.
And then brought back. Right. But now my sense, they are becoming more inward looking. Okay. Just like what happened in Japan, maybe for a different reason. I think now maybe less Chinese are interested in coming to study. I think like in this country, I heard that last year it cut into half of pre-pandemic level.
Wow.
Okay, so even accounting for the impact of pandemic, it really declined.
Yeah,
and I heard that
that's in the hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, I heard that now. They're not really encouraging young people to go out to study or experience.
Mm.
So I think whether China can maintain openness, I mean, that's very important because that's one big factor for China's success. And I have some former students are teaching at top Chinese universities.
Right.
They are saying that in the past, they were encouraged or even pushed to write articles in English. But now they have to publish in Chinese as well.
Mm.
Okay, so there's quite a change. So I think that's one. The other one, political leadership. And certainly, China was not and is not a liberal democracy in the sense that we understand here. But still, they had a very well designed way of power transition and succession, because as you know, the main challenge for any authoritarian regime is a power succession,
right?
Right. So, I mean, like North Korea is a dynasty, for example. So, you know, like, two term, right? And then 10 years, and, fairly transparent, in a way of power succession has been in place for the last few decades. But now, Xi Jinping, broke the tradition.
Yeah.
And, he might stay forever in power. And there may not be different voices within the power elite in China. So, can China sustain their success with this different leadership style? I'm a little skeptical, okay? And the third one, here I'm a little bit careful, but in Palo Alto, there's a town what you call rich mandarins, which means that a lot of wealthy Chinese come here and stay, okay? I mean, they had right. nice homes and so on. So, my interpretation is that, they may not have much faith in their own country, even though they are very successful, okay? So, my own view is that I don't think China can take over United States in my generation. So, I mean, China has done remarkable, success for last several, decades. And I'm not sure they're moving forward or going backwards. And my own sense may not be moving forward. So that's my concern. And India, I have more mixed feeling because, as I mentioned, a lot of talented Indians coming to U.S. and be successful. And, they engage home country. They are developing, very fast. Okay. And then, at least for now and probably in the near future, India doesn't have any conflict with the United States in the way China had, right? That's but at the same time, inside India now, they're promoting Hindu nationalism, a lot of racism. So politically, I mean, in India saying we are the largest democratic country in the world, I'm not sure their democracy is moving forward or going backwards. So, I mean, that's why there's some promising aspects, but also some area of concern for India. So, I cannot claim expert in China or India per se,
right.
But by looking from like a Silicon Valley from Stanford, that's my honest view. And I may be wrong, and hopefully I'm wrong. But then I'm quite concerned. Yeah.
My sister spends hours watching Korean drama every week. And sometimes she doesn't even look at the subtitles. It makes me think that she understands Korean, but she doesn't.
Right.
But she already follows, right? And it's really amazing how you have grown economically, how you've projected soft power all across the world.
Right.
From little towns in India to little towns in the U.S., little towns in Indonesia, in a matter of just a few decades.
Right.
This is going to be my last question.
Right.
What would be the one or two or three things that you think Southeast Asia could learn from South Korea?
Yeah.
So that we could be as badass as you.
Right, so, I mean, that's also an amazing story because usually you have to have, economic capital, before promoting cultural capital. But it's not an easy process. You might become wealthy, but may not be able to convert economic into cultural capital, right?
Yeah.
And, frankly, maybe shame on myself, but I've been sort of discounting the importance of this cultural power. I thought, maybe just like for a few years then and go away. But now I realize that it's real. So in my course in Korea, I began to cover Korean soft power, especially K-drama and K-pop, finally. And I'm trying to explain the success. And last year, we had a 20th anniversary of a Korea program at Stanford. And then we had like, you know, North Korea and then K-pop, because you know, these are two issues that American audience are interested in. So we had like, you know, Ban Ki-moon, former UN Secretary General, among other people. Then also we have a K-pop star, Suho of EXO. It's a really new experience, because the response by young people, including our own students, is just amazing. And you know, your show reached to a lot of people, but you know, my lecture never goes to 1,000 people, right? But then when you know, these K-pop stars came to our campus to give a talk, it's not really performance, it's just like talk and discussion. You know, the response has been tremendous. And I think we got the most hits for this talk. And I think one example, like the university communication team, so they did Instagram when Suho came. So I heard almost like more than 40,000 people say, you know, I like this, right? And I think 2 weeks before Obama came, then the same thing, they only like 20,000. So we are joking that, you know, Suho beat Obama quite nicely.
We're viewed by more than 20,000.
Right. So that's one example. And I think I have given, you know, a few interviews on this topic to Korean, you know, TV and some documentary. And I don't know, you know, one is, you know, Korea was able to address some, you know, universal issue like inequality, for example. So like the director of, you know, Parasite, so actually he went to the same department as mine. I mean, it's like maybe 10 years younger than me. And, you know, was able to address pretty well using, you know, Korea as a case, but addressing more general issue. Like BTS, I think their message is quite positive, like, you know, love yourself.
Yeah.
So, you know, K-pop doesn't deal with, like, you know, sex and drugs as in some other, you know, countries.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So a very clean image and, you know, fandom. Yeah. So, you know, certainly whether they can sustain current success, I mean, that's a big question too. But so far, it's amazing that K-pop, you know, K-drama are so successful. So, I mean, even in Palo Alto, sometimes when I go to a restaurant, and like, you know, Mexican, let's say, you know, lady serving my table, and when she found out I'm Korean, then, oh my God, do you know Crash Landing? And all of a sudden, we engage
Dynamite,
in conversation
BTS.
For like, you know, several, you know, several minutes. So, it's quite amazing. And but still, one issue, if you look at least like, I think initially it spread to like, you know, Asia, like Japan, Korea, China, Southeast Asia, then here. But here still the main audience are like Asian American or more ethnic minorities and female. I don't think K culture was able to penetrate sort of what you call mainstream,
right?
Like a white Caucasian male. So there are certain limitation in that regard.
There's 700 million people in Southeast Asia.
Right.
How do you get every one of the 700 million people to have the same kind of hunger,
right,
thirst, drive for excellence,
right,
the way the Koreans have shown?
Right.
How do you do that?
I mean, I'm still trying to figure out because, you know, I began to watch K-drama during the pandemic. Nothing else to do. And I think also, in a sense, it was lucky to be able to use a global platform like Netflix and, you know, YouTube, right? Because they were not made by Korean. But then Korean was able to utilize those very effectively. So let's say, you know, without this global platform, probably much more challenging, right? But still then why Korean movie, why Korean drama,
Korean manufacturing,
right,
capabilities.
Right. So on April 19, we are going to have a special conference on K-drama and cinema. So maybe some of you can see, you know, we have some, you know, Korean writer and actor, and we have, you know, panel to talk about this issue, you know, why Korean, you know, drama has been able to succeed, and can it be sustainable, and so on. So it's April 19th.
I'll be there. Last one. I've gone to school with so many Koreans. Mm. I've known so many Koreans on a golf course, on a tennis court, in social scenes, in the entrepreneurial space. Mm. I've not met any Korean who's not competitive. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And that I think is something that the Southeast Asians need to take a look at if we want to be, you know, in any way slightly better.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. But I think for Korea to survive,
yeah,
you really have to be competitive.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, you know, Korea is surrounded by big power.
Yeah.
You know, I've been telling my, you know, students saying that, you know, Korean Peninsula, if you move Korean Peninsula from Northeast Asia to Europe, you know, Korea is not a small country.
Yeah.
Right? In terms of size and population. But in Northeast Asia, Korea looks very small. You know, China is huge. You know, Russia is big. You know, Japan is not in a small country either, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, Korea has survived, you know, Chinese dominance for many, you know, centuries, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, how? I think Korea has to be very competitive.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why they have to work very hard. So sometimes maybe a little too excessive, but investing in the human capital and then connected to the outside. I think that's the only way Korea can survive.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I mean, Korea doesn't have the size of Indonesian population.
Yeah.
Korea doesn't have natural resources that you have in your country, right?
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? I mean, you have, you know, your only people.
Yeah.
Small country. Just have to work very hard and be competitive. That's the only way to survive. And I think so far, Korea has done pretty well.
Well done. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Okay. So, 테리마 가신.
감사합니다.
Yeah, 감사합니다. Thank you.
That was Professor Giwook Shin, Director of APARC at Stanford University. Thank you.
Inilah Endgame.
Yeah. Thanks.